My name is Linda Childers, and I'm with the Daniels Fund in Denver, Colorado. And it's my honor tonight to welcome you to the opening dinner for the Philanthropy Roundtable. We're anxious to hear the story of philanthropy and the future of scouting. So to get us started this evening, please welcome representatives from Scout Troop 89 and Venturing Crew 809 from the local area. Thank you, Color Guard. And now will you please join me in welcoming Steve Fries, who will give the invocation for this evening. Steve, as many of you know, lives in the beautiful location of Jackson, Wyoming. He is a trustee with the Lynn and Foster Fries Foundation and works with his father to oversee the giving of the foundation. Steve.
Almighty God, creator of heaven and earth, grantor of our inalienable rights, we ask that you bless our time together here in this beautiful corner of your creation. We thank you, O Lord, for the gifts and privileges you've bestowed upon us, and we recognize that with these gifts come great responsibilities. Holy Scriptures tell of Solomon praying for wisdom and it being granted to him. We too pray for your wisdom as we strive to be good and faithful servants in the stewardship of the resources which we direct to the benefit of our fellow man. We thank you, God, for this country whose very founding documents acknowledge your sovereignty. John Adams said, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." We recognize that the preservation of that moral character is a task requiring constant vigilance. And we thank you, Lord, for the 100 years of service the Boy Scouts of America has provided in this task. We thank you for its influence in the lives of some 100 million of our nation's youth, many of whom today lead us in industry and government. Help us, O Lord, to honor the spirit of the Scouts' oath ever near, that we too, on our honor, will do our best to do our duty to God and our country. Grant, Lord, that we too will follow the Scout law, that we will be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. We thank you, Lord, for the freedom we enjoy in this country. And in your holy name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Steve. Please enjoy your dinner and great conversation, and we'll be back in about 35 or 40 minutes. I hate to interrupt this wonderful conversation, but we have a treat in store for us this evening. Daniels Fund is a proud supporter of the Boy Scouts, and that tradition started back with our founder, Bill Daniels. And what resonated with Bill was Boy Scouts' core principles. He loved the service to others, the courtesy, the balance between self-sufficiency and teamwork, the discipline, the respect, and the positive adult role models that Scouts provided. I'm going to welcome to the podium right now Russ Harden. Russ will introduce our speaker. But let me tell you a little bit about Russ first. Russ is the president of three separate but somewhat related foundations, all with ties to the Coca-Cola Company. The foundation is primarily working in the state of Georgia. They focus on education, health, human welfare, environment, community and economic development, philanthropy and volunteerism, and the arts. So he's a busy guy. Russ is trained as a lawyer, but has been in the foundation business since 1988 and became the president of those three foundations in 2006. So Russ, will you come and introduce our speaker for tonight?
Thank you. I'm Russ Harden. The largest of those foundations that I serve is the Woodruff Foundation. I want to talk just a minute about Robert Woodruff and that foundation, and then I want to talk about a couple of other people before I get to Bob Mazuka, who is our speaker tonight. I promise I'll make it very short. Robert Woodruff, though, is one of the reasons why I feel particularly privileged to be here tonight to introduce the leader of the Boy Scouts of America. You may not know much about Robert Woodruff. He was the longtime chairman of the Coca-Cola Company. He meant for you not to know much about him. His biography was titled Mr. Anonymous. He was very quiet about his giving, and we tend to follow his philosophy and style in our own giving today at the Woodruff Foundation. But Boy Scouts was an important organization, an important program, and a priority for Mr. Woodruff in his own personal giving, and continues to be for the Woodruff Foundation today. Like many of you, we've supported our own Atlanta Area Council and are proud of the investments we have made in one of the best scouting programs and one of the largest scouting programs in the country. So I'm particularly pleased to be here to represent the Woodruff Foundation. But I want to tell you about two or three other people that make it a privilege for me to be here. I was just talking at our table about my own scoutmaster when I was growing up in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I moved to Spartanburg when I was 11 years old in 1968. I didn't know anybody in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I had two sisters. I had a father whose idea of an outdoor experience was 18 holes of golf. Somehow I stumbled in to the Scout Hut at St. John's Lutheran Church, and 4 years later I strode out an Eagle Scout because of, largely, the support and encouragement that I received from Lawrence D. Chapman. God bless him. I think of him every time I meet an adult leader, the lifeblood of scouting in this country. Thousands and thousands of Lawrence D. Chapmans are out there having the same kind of impact that he had on me with lots of boys all over the country. Tonight, at scout huts all over the country, there are boys meeting, and I have tremendous respect for those adult leaders who make it possible. I have to tell you, though, about two other folks, and those are my two boys. Scouting meant a lot to me. It meant much more to my two sons, both of whom are Eagle Scouts. I grew up in Spartanburg, South Carolina. There wasn't anything else to do in Spartanburg but Boy Scouts. My boys have grown up in Atlanta, Georgia, where there's a lot to do. Sports are a whole lot better organized than they were when I was a kid. Their schools are terrific. They had lots of competing interests. And we encouraged them pretty strongly to stick with scouting. I'm so glad they did. Through scouting, they derived values. The influence of scouting is significant in their life. They learned through scouting about values that seem almost countercultural now, and that they wouldn't have picked up and wouldn't have been reinforced in other avenues. My boys learned about self-discipline as opposed to self-esteem. They learned through scouting about teamwork and working together. They learned plenty about competition and sports, but in scouting they learned about working together. They learned about we rather than I. They learned, I hope, a sense of responsibility. They learned some old-fashioned virtues like patriotism and responsibility to country and to community. I'm grateful for the influence that scouting had on their lives. That's why it's such a privilege for me tonight to introduce Bob Mazuka. Bob, in 2007, became the Chief Scout Executive of Boy Scouts of America. He is a career scouting executive. He has spent 40 years as a leader in scouting and various roles and responsibilities all over the country. He is originally from California. He asked me not to tell you that. He's a graduate of Caltech. He now lives in Irving, Texas, where scouting has its headquarters, but he's all over the country, and he's all over the country talking about the values of scouting. He is the man responsible for articulating those timeless values of scouting, defining those values, and by all accounts, he's the man for the job. An organization 100 years old needs to evolve and needs to change, and he's all about the change that scouting needs to make, but he's also profoundly committed to the values of scouting. I'm looking forward to hearing him talk about those values tonight, so please join me in welcoming Bob Mazurka.
What he said. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Great job. Wow. You've taken about 10 minutes off of what I'm going to talk about. It's wonderful. What a thrill to be here. Thank you so much for the honor and the privilege of addressing this group. You know, for a long, long time, I recognize the work of the Philanthropy Roundtable and the members of the Philanthropy Roundtable as being so hugely important to the agenda of evolving and developing and nurturing communities all across the country. And the whole notion of philanthropists as partners rather than donors is something that I believe very, very deeply in. As a matter of fact, we're into the middle of one of those adventures now. One of your members, you may have heard, Stephen Bechtel, his $50 million commitment to our adventure at the summit, the Bechtel Family National Scout Reserve in West Virginia, we'll talk a little more about that a little later, is a great example of what I'm talking about with regard to philanthropists as partners. With Stephen, if you want his money, you get him too. And that's a good thing. That's a really, really good thing. You know, I've been career scouter for 40 years. I've been fundraising all of those 40 years. And you haven't lived as a fundraiser until you've looked someone in the eye and shared a vision and asked them for $50 million. And then had them say yes. It's kind of like the dog caught the bumper, you know. What do you do now? What do you do now? We're so thrilled to be a partner with Stephen in this vision of the summit. And we will, I promise, to return to that in just a moment. As you know, as many of you have heard or knew ahead of time, we're in the fourth quarter, beginning the fourth quarter of our 100th anniversary celebration, the Boy Scouts of America. 100 years. How about that? Now, I would submit to anyone, I'm not accusing anyone here of knowing this personally, but I would submit that anyone or anything that reaches 100 years has earned the right to a little arthritis. You know, a little, moving a little slow kind of thing. Well, the Boy Scouts of America, frankly, over that 100 years, has a lot to be proud of, but we had become fairly arthritic and fairly bureaucratic and fairly stodgy and certainly not very nimble in our ability to identify and respond to modern families and modern parents in ways that they needed us to respond. So we hired the McKinsey Company. We'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow morning. We've created what we call euphemistically kind of the new BSA, and it's our approach to reaching families today. But this 100th anniversary gave us an opportunity that I thought was really important. As a matter of fact, when the selection committee gathered to hire the interview and select the next chief, I'm so honored to be the 11th chief scout executive in the history of the Boy Scouts, and this our 100th anniversary. It's so incredible. Pinch me, but don't wake me up. But when they gathered, we had this wonderful session with wonderful folks around the room who are all desperately committed to scouting and its mission. And I said to them, if you know, we've got lots of ways to go if you want the status quo, but if you want me, these are what I stand for. And first and foremost, what I really believed is that we needed to use some reason, some excuse, or some venue to what I call reintroduce scouting to the American people. And in my opinion, the 100th anniversary was the absolute perfect way to do that. We had a choice. We could have either decided that, and as we sat around talking about what are we going to do for this 100th adventure, we could have decided that we were going to bake a big birthday cake and throw the obligatory gala in Washington, D.C., which we did, by the way. It was a wonderful event. But we could just throw the obligatory gala, cut the cake, and stand around and talk about the good old days. Or we could just choose door number two and say we're going to take this adventure called the 100th anniversary and use a year-long intentional celebration to reintroduce scouting to the American people. Because you see, for far too long, in my opinion, well over a decade, almost two, we've allowed ourselves to be defined by other people. We've allowed ourselves to be co-opted by others for their own agenda. And we have such a marvelous story to tell, and yet we abandon the telling of that story. And so I thought it was absolutely critical, unless we wanted to live with the consequences of others' definition of us, that we seize the day. And I'm going to give you a bit of an example, and you stole some of my thunder here, but I wear this lapel pin or something like it every place that I go, because it's a great conversation starter. And it kind of goes something like this, because I travel a lot, especially this year. But you get on the plane, you go to take your coat off, and your seatmate looks over and says, "Oh, that's the Boy Scout emblem, isn't it?" And very proudly, you say, "Yes, it is. It certainly is." Invariably, one version of this next question is the next thing out of his mouth. Are they still around? Are they still around? We only have 3 million kids, 1.2 million adults. We're still one of the greatest forces for good on the face of the planet when you combine that with all of world scouting around the movement. As a matter of fact, in 2009, we produced for the fifth year in a row a record Eagle class, 52,469 Eagle Scouts. What a marvelous gift to America that is. And yet here's a man who has to quickly recognizes the emblem and then says, "Are they still around?" So I proceed to tell him all of those facts and say, "Yes, we are. Thank you." And then I sit down, I put on my Bose headset and plug in my iPod. I listen to books. I'm tired. I want to go to sleep. And we take off. Tap, tap, tap. "Now that you mention it," he says. "Well, wait a minute. I didn't mention it. You did. But now that you mention it, let me tell you about old Joe Cobus, my scoutmaster. And let me tell you the story, Russ, about what an influence he was on my life. Next to my dad, he was the most important man in my life." So I proceed to tell him about Roy Pedersen, my scoutmaster. And we swap scoutmaster stories. It's really cool. Hunker down. It's time to go to sleep. Another couple hundred miles. Tap, tap, tap. Got me thinking. "You know old Camp Wally Gazip? I need to tell you a story about Camp." He said, "There's some stories I can't tell you, but I can tell you this one about Camp Wally Gazip." And he proceeds to tell me about this transformational experience, or two or three, that he had as a boy at summer camp. And so I proceed to tell him about Camp Pico Blanco and my experience as a camper and then a staff member at Camp Pico Blanco, and the fact that I'm in the career that I'm in because of my experience at Camp Pico Blanco. And then invariably there comes the inevitable. "You know, the biggest regret of my life is," what? "Come on. I didn't make Eagle. Somebody got it. I didn't make Eagle. You know, I got the star, I got the life, I didn't make Eagle. Biggest regret of my life." And I say, "Yeah, I understand. I get that all the time. You got the fumes. Perfume, gas fumes, or both, and you're straight off the reservation. And I understand. But you still know the scout oath and law. I'll bet if you really thought about it, you could say that." And he said, "Yeah, I can. I actually can." He starts that, you know. I said, "Well, then we did our job. We did our job." And this is where the scout training kicks in. You see, I'm man enough not to tell him I got mine. So we don't go there. Or conversely, if he did get it, conversely, he will be sure to tell me the proudest day of my life was the day that my mom or my dad or both pinned that badge on my chest. You see, it's iconic. It's iconic. And why do I say it? Why do I tell you all of this? Because, in fact, there's this incredible pent-up sort of where-did-they-go sentiment across the country. We have 50 million alumni out there, at least, pent-up, wanting to come back into the tent, but we've abandoned their opportunity by not even engaging in a dialogue about scouting. And that's so refreshing to me to know that there are so many out there who have such wonderful, fond memories of the impact of scouting, that we're not going to let a day go by during this 100th anniversary and beyond without inviting folks back into the tent. So, what does that mean as we launch the second century? This is all about the last century. And again, don't get me wrong, it was a wonderful, glorious century of scouting. We have so much to be proud of. But if we don't capture this opportunity to talk about the future, shame on us, because the past is the past, and tomorrow is the future. So what are we doing about that? How are we describing and positioning scouting to continue to make the difference that it's made? One, I think I would submit, one of the greatest, most bold statements we could possibly make was the statement we've made in West Virginia. When you think about what that means for our future, by proclaiming the fact that we're going to take our own destiny back in our hands, we're going to create a venue for our every 4-year annual iconic National Jamboree. We're going to open a new high adventure base to expose even more kids to mountaintop experiences that change their lives. We're going to open a leadership center for excellence for young people where we can actually convene around what is a leader and what makes a good leader. That's the boldest statement we can make. That proclaims we're going to be around for a while, and Stephen Bechtel made that launch possible. I'm pleased to tell you that yesterday at our board meeting in Dallas, our national board meeting, we announced, and next week in West Virginia, we've committed we're going to have a groundbreaking every $100 million that we raise. And so next week in West Virginia, and yesterday at the board meeting, we announced another marvelous philanthropist, $25 million commitment, Walter Scott, to this adventure. And there's this beautiful valley on the Bechtel property where the core of this whole adventure will be, and that's going to be called the Scott Valley, because he shares Stephen's vision with what this could be. And Consol Energy, Brett Harvey, father of two Eagle Scouts, wonderful man. This property is gorgeous and spectacular, but there's a little ravine here, not quite so little, that needs to be connected by this sort of iconic eye candy bridge. It's going to be the Consol Bridge. You know, I've been raising money for 40 years and wanting to sell a bridge to somebody, and we finally did it. We sold Brett a bridge. So the summit and the Bechtel Family National Scout Reserve is going to become an iconic statement about the future of the Boy Scouts of America. Another reality that we've woken up to, probably a little later than most of you, is the reality of this marvelous change in the texture and fabric of our society called this Hispanic phenomenon. And how are we going to engage that in a way that invites these Hispanic families to share in this scouting experience? And for me, it's personal. You see, I'm the son of an Italian immigrant. I know what it's like to live in an immigrant family who's trying the very best they can to reach their little piece of the American dream and typically achieve that through their children. I know what that's like. And so our intentional commitment to serve Hispanics, historically, we've always had this commitment, but our thoughts in the past have always been, well, just change everything to Spanish. So, okay, we did. You know, we put the little brochures and books and stuff in Spanish. And what that accomplished was so short-sighted because it was a bunch of Caucasian concepts put in Spanish words. Nothing resonated because we didn't understand where they were coming from and what they needed. For example, we're one of 160 nations with scouting around the world. And in most Latin American countries, there is scouting, and really good scouting. But for example, in Mexico, scouting is a relatively small group, and it's for the very wealthy. It's for the affluent. Well, those aren't the people that are coming here. And so as when you ask them about their perceptions of scouting, they'll tell you they think it's a pretty good thing, but it's totally unattainable for them. So how do we craft messages and resonate? We've done some wonderful things. We've recruited Ralph De La Vega, the CEO of AT&T Wireless, a Cuban immigrant, refugee from Cuba, Eagle Scout here in this country. He's built a great committee. We're doing some incredible things. We've hired a company, HCN, Hispanic Communications Network, out of Washington, D.C., to help us build materials and collateral that'll resonate. We're learning a lot. And just one small example in Fresno, California, where obviously there's a Hispanic need. 18 months ago, they had 232 Hispanic families. Yesterday, they had almost 2,800. Because we're trying to figure out, we've got pilot councils, we're doing what we really believe we need to do there. Got some real criticism on the Hispanic handbook. We've created the Boy Scout handbook in Spanish and got some pushback from some folks who said, you know, they're in this country now, they ought to speak English. So I'm at a focus group in Los Angeles meeting with a group of Hispanic parents, and I asked this mother from Colombia with two children in scouting, through an interpreter, what did you think about the handbook in Spanish? Because obviously her children are going to schools in L.A., and they could probably read the book in English, and they did. She said, back through the interpreter, it's the greatest welcome mat I've ever seen. It says to me that you care enough to let us understand and participate with our children, so now we can follow along and be part of their adventure. Got a little bit of criticism from that. But it's working. We're excited about our adventure in Hispanics. The demographic realities drive us there, and it's the right thing to do. In technology, 3 years ago I couldn't spell blog. Now I write one. I had no idea what a blog was. I had no idea what any of this stuff is, and now I've got an iPhone. It's an iPhone 4, by the way. And on this, incredibly enough, is the Boy Scout Handbook, a downloadable app that you can just pop it right up there and read the Boy Scout Handbook. It's critically important for us to come out of the dark ages and understand the whole concept of social networking and where people meet and gather and get their information, how to use and leverage things like Facebook to spread the virally the scouting word. Now, that's a very dangerous proposition for an organization who historically has been bound to control the message. You don't control the message in the social network environment. But the power of that is something we need to learn. Another criticism we've taken is on the new Boy Scout shirt is an iPod pocket on the left sleeve. It's not a cigarette pocket. It's an iPod pocket. And I've had some really good, wonderful scoutmasters push back and say, you know what, I want those kids to leave that home. Why are you doing that? And I say to them, you tell a 12-year-old, we want you to come spend inordinate amounts of time with us out in the woods somewhere, and you have to leave that at home, they're going to opt to stay home with it. We've used tools for 100 years. This is just another tool. What's the difference between a boy reaching into his backpack and pulling out a field book to look and see if he can eat that plant, or if that snake's going to eat him, or doing the same thing with his iPod? It's just a tool. So those are things that are driving some of our conservatives very nuts, but it's got to happen, because if we can't get them in the tent, we can't impact the things that we do to impact them. And why is that even important? I mean, we're pretty archaic, right? This code of chivalry called a law and a code. In today's world, is that really necessary? What would be the difference if you woke up tomorrow morning and there were no Boy Scouts? There's no downside to that, is there? Aside from my job, I say yeah. I say yeah. You see, because for a century now, we've been delivering to American communities and therefore the American people and the population of this country, young people who are physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. That's in our DNA. Let's examine those very quickly, each one of those. What is this physically strong stuff and why? Dr. Richard Carmona, when he was Surgeon General, by the way, a story for another day, what a great example of bootstraps up from the bottom, up from the ghetto, and up from the gutter, and becoming the very best you can be. Carmona's a wonderful man. Testifying before Congress on the plight of children in America. In there, he said a lot of stuff above my pay grade. I don't understand it all, but I understand one paragraph that I hope scares you as much as it did me. When he said to the Congress, to the committee he was testifying before, that we're on the verge of having the first generation in our history that's likely to be less healthy and live fewer years than our parents because of the sedentary lifestyle of young people today, because of the onset of childhood obesity and the onset of adult diseases in children because of that sedentary lifestyle. We're on the verge of having the first generation in our history to be less healthy and live fewer years than our parents. Now, that has a whole lot more to do with all of us than it does the Boy Scouts of America. Think about it. Who's going to pay the health costs? We can't figure out how to pay the ones we have now. As American entrepreneurs, where are you going to find a workforce that comes to work every day and gives you a day's work for a day's pay, healthy and vibrant, to keep your products and services and goods competitive in today's global marketplace? I travel every day, and when I travel, one of the most uplifting experiences for me is going through an airport and seeing all of these marvelous young Americans in military uniform, either coming back or going to far-flung places in the world to defend the freedoms that we love so much and I hope we don't take for granted. Where are we going to find a vibrant, dynamic, youthful population that can continue that tradition of young Americans to keep us all the way we need to be kept? So what has that got to do with scouting? Every council in America has resources that are outdoor, camping. We own the outdoors. We need to be advocates for kids. We need to partner with the YMCA and the Boys and Girls Clubs, and Roxanne and Neil, I know, are either here or will be here. We need to use our resources together to be advocates for kids. No kid left inside. And along the way, when you get involved in scouting, you learn a couple of things. You learn, number one, to succeed, you got to reach back and bring somebody with you. You learn that nobody has to lose for you to win. In fact, everybody makes the team in the Boy Scouts. To get to the top of the mountain by yourself is an achievement. To get there with your buddies is glorious. That's what you learn in scouting. So physically strong is something we can contribute to. Mentally awake, what's that all about? Some of you may recall that tornado that tore through Little Sioux Scout Ranch a couple summers ago, killed 4 scouts, put several others in the hospital. Tragedy, terrible. Immediately after it happened, I left for Omaha. I visited those 4 families. What incredible, strong, faith-based, remarkable families they were, and what a great big scouting community hug they had to support them. 2 of those families have become my wife and my dearest friends. Went to the hospital, visited every kid in the hospital. Incredible. One young man named Javier, 16 years old, had the ugliest head I've ever seen. He had 52 staples holding his head together. And he told me this story. He said, Mr. Mazuka, keep in mind that most of the injuries and deaths occurred in this one building that was hit by this tornado that was there 1 minute and gone next. Nothing but the slab left, and those kids were in that building. Javier was hit by a piece of the chimney as it was flying away. He was laying on the ground. He said, I know I'm bleeding. I know I'm dying. He said, I knew I was going to die. The next thing I know, I see there's a bare hand on my head, put the bag flap of my scalp back on and pushed on and gave pressure to slow down the bleeding, and that hand was a 14-year-old boy who had a broken leg. He was a Star Scout, knew what he was doing. Knew what he was doing. The next day, on Sunday, I'm trying to rush through this because I know there's a time limit, but this is important, and I have so much to tell you, and I've got a little bit of time. Sunday, the council did a marvelous thing. Opened the camp just to families. It wasn't a media event. Matter of fact, there was a sheriff at the gate. If your name wasn't on the list, you couldn't get in. But opened it to the families to come out and see and get closure. Prior to that, interview after interview, national media and everybody else, you know, talking to these kids, saying, well, how's it feel to be a hero? And every one of them said, I'm not a hero, I'm a Boy Scout. I'm not a hero, I'm a Boy Scout. They also invited to this event on Sunday the first responders who had come out to help when that tragedy happened. And I'll never forget, these guys were standing in a group around by this slab, sitting Indian style, about a 20-year-old, obviously a volunteer fireman who was on that response team, sitting Indian style crying. He was sitting right next to a spot where a boy died in his arms. He couldn't save him. Lots of other emotions going on, but this grizzled old veteran, he'd seen it all. Looked about like you, sir. Big mustache and long hair. And grizzled old veteran. He said to me, Mr. Mazuka, let me tell you, when we got the call we were coming out here, we had to use chainsaws and pickup trucks and chains to drag trees out of the way to get in here. We knew what we were going to find when we got in here was chaos, utter chaos and devastation, death and destruction. What we found was a situation that was absolutely perfectly triaged so that every person who needed help was getting appropriate help. Most of the help was being given by boys, Boy Scouts, who were applying skills they learned in the Scout Hut on Tuesday night, doing what scouts do to be prepared and to be mentally awake. He said it was the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. And to cap it off, just one final with that, this New York reporter, first thing the press wants to know is what? Come on. Who messed up? Whose fault is this? So here's a reporter from New York, a woman with a microphone in a kid's face saying, come on, kid, tell me who messed up. He finally had enough. He said, whoa, ma'am, excuse me just a minute. Let me put it this way. I'm just so thankful this happened to us and not somebody who didn't know what to do. Boys being boys and scouts, being mentally awake. So that's what mentally awake has to do when you think about whether or not there should be scouting for the next 100 years. And finally, what about this morally straight thing? You did it. You went through it really well. But we're going to do it again. Nothing defines a scout better. Nothing. Defines a scout better than those 12 marvelous words that you heard a little bit ago. The 12 points of the scout law. If you know them, help me. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. Nothing defines a scout better than yet. And I will tell you, I don't know about you, but I have never met a single person in my life that got up in the morning and said, you know what, today's Thursday. I think it's my day to be disloyal. Or by golly, I'm going to be disrespectful today or irreverent. Or today I just feel like being a coward. Nobody sets out to be bad. Nobody sets out to embrace what you and I would call character flaws. But it's like anything else in life. Anything else in life. To become really good at it, to become proficient at it, what do you have to do? Practice, of course. And so in scout huts and church basements every night of the week across America, boys gather up with adults of good character. They memorize those words first, and then they say them every Tuesday night. And then on the weekend, they go out and they do a service project. And they learn and they feel. They help a hospice or they for an elderly care place, or they get scouting for food, or they do something, and they begin to understand what it means to help other people at all times. And then they begin to feel what it feels like to help other people. And it becomes a part of their fabric. When they elect a patrol leader among their peers, they learn democracy. They learn obedience. You follow your leader. They learn in a democracy, if you get it wrong, you fix it at the next election. They learn so many things. And then they practice, and then they practice, and they apply them, and they become a leader, and then they become a bigger leader, and then a bigger leader, and then they become a community leader. Kids today desperately need words to live by, to build a foundation so they can launch a life of character and integrity and honor and contribution, just like lives that you have lived. Thank you for allowing me to break bread with you. It's been an honor. Thank you.
Oh, you're good. You're good.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. I do. I've been told by the boss that we do have just a few minutes. I know that I'm the last thing between you and a really good time right outside. So, but there is a few minutes for questions if anyone has them. I'd be happy to try to answer them. Also, tomorrow we have this panel where we'll talk a little more about some of the technical things I talked about relative to the reinvention of the Boy Scouts.
Bob, thank you.
My
so
pleasure.
Much
thank
for
you
for being with us.